This week on Writers, Inc.
I was so sure I was going to law school. I actually sat and took the LSAT. And then in the middle of taking the LSAT, I just sort of had this moment of looking around me of like everyone very diligently taking the LSAT. And I was like, I don't want to be a lawyer. Like, what am I doing here? Like,
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. Look what I got in the mail today.
Fancy.
Your big face on a magazine. Congrats.
My big face on a magazine.
Mine is in storage.
Your face or your magazine?
No one can see this, J.D. Your audio only on the show.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He's holding a Writer's Digest with his
Most
face
of
on it.
Audio. We do have some video.
Yeah, there's a few people that watch us on YouTube, I think.
Yeah. I think I'm one of them. I like seeing me each week.
Wow.
That's cool, man.
That was fun. I mean, it brought back a lot of memories because, like, I used to read Writer's Digest, like, religiously, like, back, you know, even in my teens and stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, for them to still be around, like, I did the conference I guess it's close to a year ago now, and then sat down with it for this interview. But it's cool to, you know, be on the cover of a magazine that I read, you know, for so many years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you talk about? Yeah.
I don't remember.
Oh, perfect. Read Writer's Digest if you want to know.
Yeah, we should have copies at Author Nation.
Yeah.
Like they had that one that magazine that you did.
Oh,
a
yeah.
Years ago. Yeah. That'd be cool.
Yeah, no, we went into the 4MK stuff and what's happening there. The interview, I think, was before they announced the TV show coming out. So like I told the person that interviewed me about it, but like we weren't actually able to put it in the magazine, and I don't think they were able to get it in there. I just literally got this about an hour ago and haven't had a chance to read to see what the actual text is. But
are you gonna do like I did, like when my issue came out, I went to every Barnes and Noble within like 30 miles of me and bought every copy so that I could give it out.
You know,
I used to
do that when this kind of stuff happens, but like I've got boxes of these kind of things in the house and like that's where it goes. You know, like it goes into a box and then I never look at it again, which I know sounds kind of silly, but like even in my office, like I don't like display awards or, you know, covers or any of that kind of stuff. Cause I don't know, just, it feels weird. Like I'll give one to my daughter. I'll probably send one to my mom. And then the rest will go into storage.
I feel that. I don't know. I've always felt weird about awards though. My husband yells at me cause like, my PhD is in the back of a closet. He's like, you should hang that up. I'm like, it's fine.
I've got no clue where my college diplomas are.
This is where you and I are different. I have that stuff all. I got like photos of it plastered on the side of my van. That's how proud I am. As seen in Writer's Digest. Hey, Kevin.
You've got a wrap, like a whole wrap of your face.
Right.
You need that on a t-shirt with an arrow just pointing up at your face.
Yeah.
I'm like Troy McClure from The Simpsons. You may know me from Indie Author Magazine. Writer's Digest.
You were a Simpsons character, you would definitely be Troy McClure. That
I could see it.
Yeah.
I could see it. Yeah.
Oh boy.
All right, Troy, what is in the news?
Well, you may know me from other news items, such as authors are ditching the algorithm and selling straight to readers. More authors are selling books directly to readers instead of relying entirely on Amazon publishers and distributors. A 2025 survey found 30% of authors already sell direct, while another 30% plan to start within a year. The financial incentive can be significant. Authors may keep up to 90% of a direct sale while also gaining something Amazon doesn't provide, the customer's name and email address, allowing them to build a long-term relationship with readers. Direct sales are not necessarily easy money. Authors have to attract people to their own store and potentially deal with shipping, taxes, damaged books, and customer service. The article recommends starting with ebooks, audiobooks, and print on demand rather than immediately stocking and shipping physical books yourself.
All right. So full disclosure, I wrote this article for Forbes. But here's the reason I wanted to talk about this. I mean, I think it's something all authors should be talking about. But like, yeah. I started this article, if I had to guess, like 4 months ago, 4 or 5 months ago. And I got quotes from Joanna Penn because she talks about this all the time. I got quotes from David Vergutz, because he's got scare mail out there and a lot of stuff going on with that. And then I got like one line from Sasha Black, who I don't know. And like, when you read the actual article, they say my personal friend, Sasha Black, and they cut out Joanna, cut out David. I felt bad because like Joanna's stuff in particular was solid. Like I really wanted that in here.
Yeah, she probably had the most informed perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah. So I you know, it's like when you're dealing with editors and the editors and stuff like that, like, you know, you turn in the article and like they come back at you with changes and stuff, but you don't have a whole lot of say in what happens there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you didn't meet Sasha Black at Author Nation last year? Because she was there.
No, I mean, we've met, we've talked and stuff.
Oh,
but like,
just not your personal friend.
Yeah, like I think they actually say my personal friend because the article is written in first person or something. Yeah, like, I feel weird saying that because we are not really, you know, we're social. We've met, but that's it.
Close enough.
Again.
And I'm guessing it's probably a legal thing from the Forbes standpoint. Like they have to disclose that I actually know this person on some level.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, if you've got any like contact at all with somebody beyond just, you know, online or whatever, you probably should disclose that they're a friend. But I will say, though, like you say, up to 90%, and like you can get up to 100% of a royalty depending on where you set up and what you're selling. And, you know, especially when it comes to the digital products like ebooks and audiobook, you can set that up. Like I'm using PayHip for my storefront. And right now I get 97%. If I paid them $100 a month, I could keep 100% of anything I make. Minus credit card fees and things all get taken care of from Stripe and PayPal. So I don't have any of that coming out of my money directly.
This is honestly one of those things I think you need to decide from an author standpoint which direction you want to go, because like I can't do direct sales. If I do direct sales, then people at Simon & Schuster are going to get mad at me. The bookstores that are buying are going to get mad at me. Like the whole distribution system that I've got built is going to get angry. So you have to decide, I guess, which way you want to go. Like if I were starting off today, though, I would definitely explore this because, you know, you can make a lot more money selling direct. But like I mentioned in the article, you've got to drive all that traffic there. You know, like people right now, they walk into a Walmart, they may see my book on a shelf at Walmart and may buy it. You know, I'm not driving them there. I'm not walking them through the store and, you know, handing the book to them. And that's essentially what you have to do. If you've got a Shopify store, you've got something else. You've got to find some way to get that person in front of your title.
I just feel like it's a safety net in case something happens. Every day I hear about another author who got booted off of KDP for some reason or, you know, whatever. Plus, in the traditional publishing world, with its imminent demise, Kevin said, I feel like it's too dangerous to put all your trust in any one entity. You're right. Of course, you know, you can't, if you've got traditional deals and distribution deals, you're under contracts and there's things that limit you, but that might not keep you from doing things with a direct sales store, like selling ancillary products, you know, swag and, you know, things that are related merch to the IP. Yeah. Merch. If you've got the right to do it, some contracts prohibit that. But I would, if I were an indie author just starting out now, I don't think it's worth your time to try to invest in this as something, you know, you're hoping is going to make you $1 million or whatever. Go ahead and distribute wide, but I would go ahead and start the store now and have merch waiting there because it costs nothing for it to just be there. And then as your audience grows, you know, you could get to a point where you could move your books over to that store, but you're having like a online retail branded for you is a smart play from the start, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's something you're interested in, you know, read the article, but definitely go out there and research David and Scare Mail, because what he's doing is extremely unique. And it may be a one-off. Maybe nobody else could do it, or maybe somebody else could. But, you know, what he came up with was a, you know, very unique proposition. And I think that's why it's working so well. And Sasha, to her credit, like what she's doing, you know, with her warehouse and everything else is also big. And Joanna talks about it more from the, you know, what you're basically doing and what I think a lot of indie authors are doing, like that particular model with the Shopify store and things like that and print on demand for each title, which is another way to do it. But, you know, definitely explore all aspects of it.
All right. Well, next up, Anthropic's Claude will start adding invisible watermarks to AI-generated text. Anthropic says Claude will begin adding invisible machine-readable watermarks to AI-generated text. The goal is to make AI-generated content easier to identify. The text watermark is designed to travel with the writing when it's copied and pasted and may survive some editing. Anthropic plans to make detection tools available so users and third parties can check for the watermark. The system has important limits. A watermark does not necessarily mean Claude wrote the original text, because Claude may have only proofread, translated, or edited it. And the absence of a watermark doesn't prove something is human written, since heavy editing or paraphrasing may remove the signal. I've already seen like 1,000 people who've defeated this already online, so I don't think this is going to hold up.
All right, so slightly weird story. You sent this to all of us yesterday in a group chat, and I hadn't heard of it before. So I saw it in the group chat for the first time. I was scrolling TikTok at the time when you sent that, and when I went back to TikTok, all of a sudden my feed started filling with stories about this, which is a little scary. It was pretty wild. And I don't know if people are just speculating right now as to what that watermark is, but the one story that I saw over again was that it's not an actual watermark; it's the language that's being used. So it's basically, you know, all these AIs use a predictive algorithm to decide what word should be next in the sentence. So it's throwing specific words as that next word, and you know, that's how it's determining whether or not that's, you know, was
it
written.
Basically is creating like a numeric fingerprint, and so you'll be able to scan that. So there's certain limitations here, like, you know, that fingerprint's only applicable to things generated or proofed by Claude. So it's not like you could, you know, plug it into ChatGPT or something. And from what I understand, there has to be there's certain specific things that have to be present, some sort of code or something that allows you to check that against Claude's system or whatever. But I'm irritated by this only mostly because of the aspect of, even if you just dropped your stuff into Claude and asked it to help you find a typo, now it's got that fingerprint, and there are idiots out there who are going to, you know, tear an author down and ruin their career and, you know, torch their reputation based on that alone. So it's no better than this scammy AI detection software. It may even be worse.
Yeah, the company said that it still isn't like proof of authorship. So
yeah,
they're saying, yeah, we've got this, but
they're just doing it as an EU compliance thing.
Still can't tell whether someone used AI to write, right? So
Kevin just kind of hit the nail on the head. That's where this is coming from. Gemini has already done it. Claude is basically stepping up. ChatGPT is going to have to do it.
Yeah.
So they just haven't announced it yet.
So what happens, though, when somebody takes someone else's work and drops it into Claude and gets that fingerprint? And then somebody scans it.
I'm not sure that's the way that it works.
That wouldn't create the fingerprint. That would train the AI.
It's actually the string of text, right? Like, so Claude actually has to write the text.
It's like a mathematical formula based on like how predictable.
Yeah.
Right, but it specifically says that if you're using it to scan, if you drop your text into it, it also generates that fingerprint. That watermark.
I don't think so. I think it's like if it proofreads and you take its
word for word suggestions,
changes word for word suggestions, then you might get. I don't know. I don't think it's any more reliable than the AI detectors, honestly.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree with that.
I hear what you're saying, even about editing, but I guess my counter argument to that would be like, you know, people are going to get upset at that because, you know, you're not paying a human editor, which, you know, human touch. And, you know, so I don't know. I think for the, I don't know. I just keep coming back to like, if you write fiction, don't use AI. Just don't use it.
That's the real answer.
Like, that's just, you just can't use it. Like, it's especially with like laws that are coming up. And I know JD's pointed this out like multiple times, like it could inhibit like what countries you're allowed to sell in and what kind of deals you can get. I mean, it's not just necessarily about witch hunts. It's like about, you know, legal things like trademarks and copyrights. And I just think, you know, it's a fun new toy, but like, You just shouldn't use it.
I agree. You shouldn't use it to write, for sure.
All right. What else you got, Kevin?
David Ellison floats Hollywood exit as states threaten to threaten his Warner Brothers deal. Paramount CEO David Ellison is considering moving the company out of California if a multi-state lawsuit blocking Paramount's $111 billion acquisition of Warner Brothers Discovery does not make progress. He reportedly told executives that a withdrawal from California could begin as early as October 1st. The pressure is partly financial. Paramount is set to owe Warner Brothers shareholders $650 million every quarter starting in October until the deal closes. California Attorney General Rob Bonta called the relocation threat an attempt to pressure regulators. I, for one, support this move to destroy Hollywood.
Well, I have a question, though, because this is an antitrust case, right? Like, this is a monopoly case. So that's federal. Like, I mean, how is moving out of California going to do anything to stop?
Well, I think California is going after him specifically, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
There's a number of states that joined together that are suing to stop this.
Yeah.
So it's not the antitrust portion that's being challenged. It's the, you know, it's being challenged basically from another side. But the truth of this is, you know, like Hollywood in a lot of ways is dead. You know, like the iconic Hollywood that we grew up with, you know, is gone. You know, like they are filming very little in that area anymore. You know, productions are all over the world. The stars are no longer concentrated in, you know, California the way they used to be in the Hollywood area. They're all over the world. And, you know, to be honest, you know, like when you really take a step back, like I wouldn't be surprised if Ellis is looking for a way to just move out of California just to get away from the tax situation. Because, you know, like I just saw an interview with Mel Gibson. There's a movie with, I think it was with Mark Wahlberg that he produced. But they took the entire production overseas and filmed particular scenes overseas because it was cheaper to do it there than it was to actually film them in California, where all the players were actually, you know, at. So like that kind of thing is happening a lot. You know, and if you look at, you know, like I know at one point they tried to, you know, create like a mini Hollywood in Florida. You know, Texas has been on their map for a long time. There are a lot of states that are tax friendly, that are film friendly, that would invite this business in a heartbeat. So I think Ellis is looking for a way out, and this is just giving him a good excuse.
Yeah. I agree with that. I think it's financial. 'Cause he also talked about selling the studio, the back lot, which is worth $4 billion. So he's going to send that, sell that, move elsewhere.
It's prime real estate in the middle of LA, you know, and like you can go out to Texas right now and buy thousands of acres for pennies, you know, for a fraction of what you're paying in LA.
Yep. I look forward to seeing the entire thing topple and burn to the ground.
Oh boy.
Katie, will you buy the Warner Brothers water tower?
Oh yeah. That'd be cool.
I'll put that in my backyard.
You've been talking about an indoor pool.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the perfect solution.
Yeah, it's above. You can build it right up and swim in the Warner Brothers Tower. Anyway, with that, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got the number one New York Times bestseller, Alexandra Bracken, coming on. Alexandra sold her first book in college and later moved to New York City to work for a children's book publisher, first as an editorial assistant, then in marketing. After 6 years, she decided to try writing full-time. Her latest book, Immortal Rose, is a slow-burn fantasy romance, and it releases August 18th. Here she is, Alexandra Bracken.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and chatting with you.
Oh, I am so excited. I saw the cover. First of all, the cover is to die for.
Isn't it pretty? I feel like I have gotten blessed by the cover gods a couple of times in my career. Well,
yes,
pretty consistently. I shouldn't say a couple times. Like, I've been very lucky with my covers, but this one is really, I think, beautiful, and it feels a little bit different from kind of the look that's out there right now for romantasy. So I'm hoping it catches people up. People's eyes, like when they see it in the store.
Well, yeah. And then I was like, perfume is magic, which
we'll
get into that. But I have been like obsessed with perfume lately. So anyway, it was like the perfect, perfect book at the time.
Oh my gosh. I could honestly talk about perfume forever and fragrance and all of that good stuff. It's like once you
dip a toe into that world, it's so hard to pull yourself back out. All of a sudden, you go from like maybe one little perfume bottle or sample, and then all of a sudden, you have an entire shelf behind you of beautiful perfume bottles and different scents for different moods and all of that.
Oh,
So,
yeah, I know. And then you start getting into the whole like top notes and bass notes.
yeah.
Yeah, anyway, yes. So,
Yeah, we will definitely get into that for sure.
yeah, but before we start talking about perfume obsessively, let's go all the way back to the beginning, your writer origin story. How did you get started writing?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I was definitely one of those like very annoying kids who had like a sense of destiny at a really young age, like somehow just knew exactly what I was supposed to do in my life. And apparently my dad was also like this, but he was like this with like real estate. Like he's like, I'm gonna sell real estate or, like as
Interesting.
like a 6-year-old. And then for me, I think it was, I remember being in like third grade, and that was the first time we'd had any sort of creative writing unit. And my wonderful teacher basically had us write these short stories that we then would illustrate. And then you would like do the cover with cardboard and contact paper and staple it all together. And I also just like really started reading a lot at that age independently. And I think in my little brain, I was kind of like, well, if it's this much fun to read a book, it must be this much fun to write a book. So I really want to write books. I want to write more stories. And then I have the, I think, somewhat typical progression of then, like in middle school and high school, writing a lot of fan fiction and kind of like learning how to write by reading
Bad
and just
poetry.
experimenting. Exactly. A ton of bad poetry, a ton of like dark, depressing poetry. The
Yes.
Scorpio Rising in me like really jumped out with like some of these themes, some of these poems, like totally fascinated with the dark side of life. But then when I was in college, my freshman year, because it wasn't already an adjustment, I was like, I really want to try to write a novel for National Novel Writing Month. I like want to see if I can do it. So I ended up doing it, and I kind of became like hooked on the process of coming up with story worlds and coming up with just novels that were completely new and completely mine. And I ended up just continuing to write all throughout college. And I actually sold my debut novel when I was a senior in college. And then, but it was like the very typical author thing of like, okay, I have fulfilled my dream, but I cannot afford to just be a writer or an author like straight off the bat. So I ended up working in publishing in addition to writing. It was sort of writing my books was kind of my weekend job. And then I worked as a editorial assistant first and then in book marketing. And finally, like after probably like 5 or 6 years, I was able to make the leap and write full time. And that's sort of brought us to today, like 16 or so books later. So I think really the like condensed version of that story is I started at a really young age and then just like never stopped writing. And that's sort of the key thing along the way. I had a lot of people who encouraged it and were like, keep going. This is kind of a weird dark poem, but like keep experimenting, keep
Got something
going.
there. Let's a bit of that. That's so interesting. Especially the jump from editorial assistant to marketing, because usually I think I've heard it is the other way around. You start in marketing and then go to editorial and then go to writing. So that's kind of an interesting.
So I did right out of school because I didn't have any sort of, this is like a weird kismet fate thing where I was so sure I was going to law school. I actually sat and took the LSAT. And then in the middle of taking the LSAT, I just sort of had this moment of looking around me of like everyone very diligently taking the LSAT. And I was like, I don't want to be a lawyer. Like, what am I doing here? I don't, you can, like, when I looked at my results later, I was like, oh, that was the moment. Like, this answer was the moment where I just sort of was like, I don't want to be a lawyer. Like, what am I even doing? But then that sent me into this tailspin of like not knowing what to do with my life. And it just so happened that my college, for whatever reason, had a scholarship for the Columbia Publishing course, which is one of a couple of different like post-degree courses that you can take that are sort of like crash courses in publishing, where this one was held at Columbia University, and you would go and live on campus for a couple of weeks, and you would attend talks, and you would form like publishing units, and you would come up with different titles and all of that, and you would learn very quickly about the publishing industry as a whole. But the biggest thing was that these
publishing courses have a job fair and they are like directly connected to the HR department. So it
Well,
does
that's
kind of
really
give you
cool.
a little bit of a leg up when you're applying for jobs. And I knew because I wanted to keep writing and eventually get to the point where I could write full time. I was like, I don't want to be an editorial assistant. I don't want to work in editorial. The work-life balance is really tough because you do so much of your reading and so much of your editing at home. And also, I think the writer brain and the editor brain are very different. There's not a ton of overlap in my own brain. And so it just so happened that that was like the first job I got offered. It was in children's publishing on working mostly on like middle grade books for boys. So it was a lot of like sports books, a lot of like, I call them like booger books with like this like level of humor, which, you know, suited me, but it was also just really tough on the work-life balance front. And so once I saw the opportunity to move into marketing, I was like, okay, that'll be better. But then I picked school and library marketing. That was where I entered the marketing side. And that involved a ton of travel. But I also had a very kind boss who would like let me go sign my books at, like while we were at, you know, ALA and all of these different school and library conventions. She would like let me have my like half hour to go sign my own little books. And that, you know, was huge when I was early on in my career. I'm really grateful to her. And they were my whole team in school library marketing, they were so supportive and I still love them to this day.
That's excellent.
So yeah, I know it. I think a lot of people really want to be on the editorial side and those jobs are so few and far between. I was like, oh, I don't want to be ungrateful, but this is not what I want to do. I just kind of have to get into the industry and have to start making some sort of income in order to live here.
Right.
With my two roommates in our very small apartment.
Yeah, nice little closets. That is very interesting, though. And I know that you have talked a lot. Like, I think I caught a call you did once with, I hope I say her name right, Susan Denard.
Yeah, Susan. Yeah.
And you guys talk about craft and sort of like the mechanics of it, which, you know, I feel get so unjustly villainized sometimes, you know, because it feels like it's not art. But I really like the mechanics save me so much, like putting a puzzle together. So I'm kind of curious, you know, how your process and your like path to craft ended up.
So this is something Susan's one of my really, really dear friends. And this is something we still talk a lot about. You know, we're talking kind of craft almost every day and kind of checking in and all of that. And Miss Stennard is like such a strong craft person. And she was studying, she was like in school for science. Like she was going to be a scientist. and so her brain is what I would call like a logic brain. And my brain is like a chaos brain. But we have kind of had a very similar journey in terms of our craft and our process, in that we both started out as not necessarily pantsers, but people who really wrote intuitively, I would say, where you are, Jenlyn Barnes calls this like writing from the id, where you are like really in tune with the different tropes that you like, and you are writing with this like huge rush of emotion. And sometimes it produces something that's like really, really messy, but like juicy and good and fun to read. And then what happens a lot too is like, and this certainly happened to me, it's like you almost overcorrect by being like, well, I am so tired of doing these enormous revisions where I'm like rewriting the book and rewriting the book because there's no actual, or it's feeling too, there was a note I would constantly get where they felt like it was an editor told me once, she's like, your writing is very episodic, which is not what you want when you are writing a novel. Great when you're writing for television or writing for comics or something like that. Just how my brain plotted was episodically. And so I went in and like really taught myself a lot about craft and read a ton of craft books and really experimented and learned. But then sometimes when you are really engaging on the craft side, then you almost start to like trust that intuitive voice in yourself less, and you kind of are moving away from the id towards like what you think, you're moving away from your lizard brain towards what you think is like better suited for craft and whatnot. And so
In, I would say the last couple of years, both Susan and I have sort of like regressed back into being more intuitive writers. But the difference is that once you have that more solid craft foundation, that is like kind of now baked into the intuitive process in a way it wasn't for us before, I would say. Does that make sense? I feel like
Yeah.
that's a lot of really random words, and I'm
No,
making a lot
that
of hand gestures trying to like
I get it.
describe what the process. But yeah, I would say I like my process these days is really like I always start with character. I know who the main character is at the beginning, who they are at the end, and then I plot kind of based off of like how I'm going to push that character into becoming the new version of themselves and kind of writing from a character first perspective. And I have learned whether this is because I possibly have ADHD or I am bored easily, I cannot like fully outline a book anymore. It just doesn't work for my brain. I have to like, I can do headlights plotting, I think is what we have decided to call it as an industry, where you kind of have like your overall journey in mind, you know, the big stops along the way, but then you're really only outlining what you're going to be working on as you reach it.
Oh,
Does that
I
make
like
sense?
that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So
that does make sense.
it definitely leaves a lot of room for discovery, but I do actually do a big outline when I'm revising because I need to like see laid out what I'm going to be changing across the story.
Yeah. That actually makes a lot of sense. I started with no plan. I just dove face first and then Frankenstein's, books together, and then was like, oh, that's terrible and it doesn't work. And anyway, so yeah.
I mean, this is the thing that I always tell like young authors too, or young writers who are like just starting out on their journey, or even like, you know, writers who are into their career and they're like, I'm really struggling or I'm having a hard time finishing books. It's like you just have to find what works for your particular brain. My brain
Yeah.
gets bored easily, and if I like do a full outline, I know my brain is going to be like, well, you already wrote the book. Like you know how it ends, like you know what happens. So like you wrote it, and then there's no real joy and like doing the hard work of actually getting the prose down. But some people really, really need and like having that structure in place, and they're, you know, able to move through the story faster and be more focused. Some people really do need more stops along the way. Other people are just like, if I'm not doing full discovery, then I'm bored, or I just can't tap into the lizard brain the way I need to, that sort of thing. So
Yeah, I
everyone is
like
so
the puzzle
different.
aspect. I definitely like
Yeah.
putting it together and figuring out how to make it work. But yeah, finding that balance, I think.
Are you somebody who loves drafting, or are you somebody who loves revising?
Revising,
Same.
drafting.
I used to love drafting, like love it. Would find any time I needed to write. I would get up at like 5 o'clock in the morning in college and write, 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 write. And I had so much fun and had so much energy doing that. And I think now, as I've gotten older, I'm like, oh God, I just want to have a draft that I can fix. Like I just want it to be
Yeah.
like have all the pieces and kind of reassemble them that way. But yeah, I don't know like why my brain that switch flipped, but I always like
Well,
asking authors that.
when I didn't know anything and was creating,
When you
just
were writing from the lizard brain only.
writing from my heart, I think it was fun. And then I think it became less fun when, as you said, like now you've got this big messy draft and you're like, oh, like I don't need to do this. And then you realize like all those things that were like a ton of fun to write, ended up being the darlings that you had to kill. And
Yeah.
so I think that makes it a little less fun. It makes
Yeah.
it, you know? You're like, oh, I don't want to just like write to like just have all these things just. Well, there they were, and they're never going to see the light of
Yeah.
day.
I mean, there's like no better feeling than when you're writing and the words are flowing and like you're really deep in the character's point of view and like you're like, oh, the jokes are hitting. You know, he's
Yeah.
making these sweeping love decor. I love this. Like she's so funny right now. And then, you know, like there are just some moments now where drafting is fully like
Yeah.
pulling teeth. Like it, I don't know, editing feels that way too. It's always hard. That's the thing about
Yeah.
writing is like it's always hard and it should be hard because that means
Yeah.
you're pushing yourself and you're growing.
I agree with that. Which I guess is a perfect time to bring up your delightful and delicious book. Where did the idea of using perfume as magic come from?
This is so funny. I like I always wish I had a better story than like a better origin for my books than like it emerged from the primordial chaos stew in my brain. It just sort of gelled together one day. But that's kind of what happened. I think if I had to like pinpoint an inspiration, like a moment where I was like, came home and was like, I think this would make a great story. I feel like I have to go back in time, which is when I was in high school and I think just after high school too. I had like a summer job working at Ulta, and I loved just finding any excuse to go over and tidy up the fragrance wall. And I think I just have always been very scent obsessed. Like it just like it's a little dopamine receptor in my lizard brain. I keep talking about the lizard brain. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Where I just like it just instantly lifts my mood. And I think for me, fragrance is just like endlessly fascinating. And perfume is just such a beautiful form of storytelling. But so, I wore perfume all throughout my high school and then into college and then as a 20-something and as a 30-something. And I would always burn a particular candle when I was working on a specific book. Like, and somehow that scent would like help me get back into that fictional world. So I was using fragrance while I was writing, just not necessarily totally conscious of it. And then I think, like many people, I somehow stumbled into perfume talk on TikTok and went down that rabbit hole. And I started, getting what you call a decant, like a little sample from scents like, or sites like Scent Split and Fragrances Line and all of this and Lucky Scent and just sampling a bunch of different scents and really expanded my knowledge of perfume about modern perfumery. And I was at the mall one day and I was like, I'm gonna smell a now a very famous perfume called Delina by Parfums de Marly. And I was like, I don't really like rose and super flowery scents, so I don't think I'm gonna like this. But then I went and I sprayed it on the little sample card and I walked around the mall and I like could not stop smelling it. Like at first I was like, oh no, it's like so rosy. I do not like this. This is too floral. This is gonna give me a headache. And then over the course of like the hour or two that I was walking around the mall, I just like kept coming back to it. I was like drawn to it, this interesting magnetism of like how the scent was shifting and how it was changing as it dried down. And then I like went back to Nordstrom and put it on my skin, and it even smelled a little bit different that way. And so as I was like driving home, I was just thinking about like kind of the magical essence at the heart of that like perfume has that ability. And thinking about too how strongly tied scent is to our memory and to our emotions. Like it's our one sense that is directly connected to the emotional and memory centers in our brain, which is why, like, when you encounter a familiar scent or like a perfume that you wore when you were younger, it's like instantly evocative for you. And then, so as I was driving home, I was like, oh, it would be so interesting to play with scent and to have a character who was a super scenter. I think the term is like hyperosmia. I probably am saying that wrong. Hyperosmia, where it's like you're a super scenter, but she can smell emotions. Like this is the fantasy brain coming into play, where it's like she can smell people's emotions, she can smell people's secrets, and she has somehow this ability to put magic into her perfumes. And so I don't know why I like came home. I think because my entry into reading romance was historical romance. And so I was like, oh, this would fit so, this like beautiful art form would fit so beautifully in kind of a Regency style era or Victorian style era. And so I was like, I don't know. Again, that's just sometimes how ideas come. It's like they just sort of gel together and you start brainstorming and kind of playing around and experimenting in that world. And so yeah, that was like such a rambling way of explaining all of that, but that's really how story ideas come together for me. It's not like I never get like the fun dream. I never like get to like read one line in a book that sparks a whole other book. Like I don't know. It's just a bunch of things that I am interested in and find fascinating and want to be able to research more about.
Well, I don't know. I kind of like that. I mean, it's speaking of, you know, just like this romantic idea, I mean, perfume is very romantic, which kind of fits with romanticism, but also, like, you know, there is something sort of very subtly sensual about perfume. And I do like the symmetry of, you know, you smell something and sometimes you're not really aware that you smelled it, and then it kind of just keeps like drifting by, and you just, you know, have to follow it. And that's kind of what you did. So I think it's a very nice,
Thank you. I will say, I hope to never have to describe how anything smells ever again in a book. I'm like, you know, where you just hit the point where you're like, oh my God, how many more ways can I describe how the air smells around her? But it is such a fun challenge. I'm working on the sequel right now. So it's such a fun challenge to think about, like, how would a certain emotion register to her nose? Like, what is the kind of like scent texture of it? Because scents can kind of have a texture where, like, a lot of, for example, like peach scents or peachy scents, you kind of get the fuzz of the peach in the scent as you are like breathing it in. And it shouldn't work that way, but it absolutely does for whatever reason.
It does.
But thinking about that and just thinking about like, how will I write a character who really understands and processes the world with her primary sense being scent? Like, this is the thing that helps keep her alive. It's the thing that helps her make money. Like, it's the thing that she loves most. And so, like, when she meets a new character, she encounters somebody, it's like that's the first thing she kind of reads about them rather than their appearance.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, there were like a lot of different elements. It's not just that the perfume is magic, but yeah, that how she interacts with scents, and you know, just even the lore around it, which, you know, you sort of, I don't know, maybe it's not fair to say sort of created an entirely new magic system, but it did feel very unique and very interesting. And I'm
I'm
wondering,
sure
like,
that there are, I like have not gone looking for them because I did not want to psych myself out.
yeah.
Like, you know what? I think like for me, I try to not read anything that's similar to like what I'm working on. I'm sure that there are other books that use some sort of like magic and perfume or magic and scents out there. So I feel like I can't totally claim to be the first person, but I really hope that people find it to be like an interesting and fresh magic system. It definitely feels, and I like don't say this in like a not like the other girls kind of way, but like I hope it does feel a little bit different from kind of the typical romancy plot that you see play out of like the secret chosen one and that sort of a thing. Because those books are so fun, but I also think we're in the prime era of romanticism where now we get to like spread our wings as a genre and we get to kind of like incorporate and fold in other subgenres and kind of you're seeing a lot more experimentation and playing around. And so I just hope it like feels fresh to readers. And my secret desire is for the romanticism readers to try reading historical romance and vice versa, because I think both groups, if they don't already cross over, would actually really love the other's worlds, so to speak.
You know, I mean, it's funny because obviously you're very aware. I mean, I was very aware as I was reading, like, this is, it's historical, you know, they're in like carriages, and like this is not, you know, there's not like cars and things like that, but it didn't, like, it didn't feel like, I don't know how, what I want to say here. It's like, it just, it feels like it fits right in. So I think that you're right. Like, it just,
Yeah, and
once
it's
you,
not, it's, I keep saying it's like Regency inspired
yeah.
because I knew, like, based on obviously perfume, I think Viola, the main character, says something to this effect in the book where hopefully this is one of the darlings that was not killed at some point in my many revisions of this book, but she kind of says something to the effect of like, perfume is the meeting of art and science. And I really loved writing about perfumery at that, you know, comparative point in history versus now, because now perfumery is like very science-based. It's a lot of like odor chemicals and scent molecules and all of this. And it's so interesting and so fascinating how these companies that are like kind of secretive develop scents for like other companies. And anyway, but like, you know, in the Regency and Victorian era,
you were really starting to get like different distillation processes. And when you were saying earlier that there is kind of like this sensual component to perfume, like at that point in time, there is no atomizer yet. So it is applied with dabbers and with the use of your finger. And so there's a scene in the book where she applies one of their earlier flirtatious moments. She applies some perfume to his arm, his forearm, which is a very big thing in historical romance.
There were some very interesting scenes.
But so I was like, I love that this is, like I love this relative era of perfumery, but in order for the modern reader to like to be able to grasp the world of perfumery in this pseudo historical setting, I did you pull in some more like modern ways of thinking about it, like the olfactory pyramid, for example, with the scent, with the different note hierarchies and whatnot, just so like the reader who is reading it now is not gonna feel completely lost or feel like they can't relate to what Viola is thinking or saying about perfumery. So I, even though it's set kind of, I would probably say in what our world would be like the 1820s, 30s, some of the stuff that she's talking about and referencing really was developed kind of towards the end of the 19th century versus the beginning of the 19th century. But so that's one of the reasons why I was like, I can't fully set it in our world. It has to be, I have to like have some room to play so the historical purists, myself included, like wouldn't just
Have a little
agonize
bit.
over any departure from historical accuracy.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I do think like that's the fun part of fantasy a little bit is you get to stretch those, like, I'm just gonna borrow this.
Like, it's so much like romanticism, historical romance has like a lot of different tropes and components to it that I like wanted those readers to recognize in this world. So like trying to
Lots of
like the
yearning.
reformed rake, the scandal sheets, that sort of a thing. So like I borrow very heavily from our world in this, and it hopefully increases what you would think of as like the reading fluency, where you're not like having to stop and track a ton of new information in this historical setting because you kind of are already a little bit familiar with it.
Yeah, it I feel like I mean I don't read a lot of the Regency romance and I can say I slipped right in. So
Perfect. Perfect. All according to plan.
perfect. Yeah, so and then this is also your first adult book, whereas you've been YA before. So what inspired you to move from YA to adult?
That is a great question. I feel like in some ways the publishing world sort of pushed me into it. Because, unfortunately, right now the YA market is very tough. It's in kind of a weird place where for a really long time, the like typical customer buying a YA book was actually
Yeah, an
like
adult.
a woman who was in her like 40s to 60s. Like there were a bunch of studies and research done on this where that kind of average YA purchaser, that reader has migrated to romantasy. Like what they loved about YA, they can now find in romantasy with characters who are closer to them in age and maybe aren't going through the first
Yeah, kind of
necessarily
the
that a lot
angst.
of, the really intense teen emotions and experiences that I think are so fun to write and read. And one of the reasons why I think YA, continues to exist and is important. But it was one of those things where I was like, I am having a harder and harder time trying to market my YA books because now it's like the YA readers are also on BookTok and they want to read what's popular on BookTok, and what's popular in BookTok are romance books or older books. And frankly, my YA books had been skewing older and older along with the rest of the genre for the past couple of books. And I was like, it's not actually going to be that big of a leap. I'm not totally sure why I'm so scared to do this other than having to face my family after writing in some spicy scenes. By the way, my mom continues to be like, I don't understand why you don't want me to read this book. And I'm like, if you read it, just don't tell me. Please, please.
Never mention it. We won't talk about it.
Please, I'll give you the chapters to skip over. Please don't tell me
What's
if you've
that
read this.
meme where it's like the guy, the comedian, he says, you know, when your family wants to read your book and you go, we're all gonna have to get real cool about a lot real
Yeah,
fast.
exactly. So I was like, okay with my sister reading it to give me her feedback and her opinions from my mom. She's like, I don't get it. Like, I'm your mother. Of course I should be able to read it. I'm like, oh, it's different. It was. I think, just wanted also the challenge of trying to write for a new age group. I'd written middle grade and I loved writing middle grade, love writing YA. I'm eventually going to work my way back down to picture books, which I think might be the hardest type of book to write for
Yeah,
because I
I would
can't
agree with
write
that.
150,000 words to tell a story. I can only, write like 30 pages worth, right? That's about the
Yeah.
average. See, so much research I have to do about before I can dive into writing a picture book. I really respect the picture book authors and illustrators out there. But yeah, I think it was kind of a combination of like moving with the market, but also just like trying to really spread my wings a little bit and try something new and push myself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I could honestly sit here and talk to you for like 10 more hours, but we
Thank you
are
for letting me
hitting
ramble at you, just talking in circles over and over again.
we're at 30 minutes, so we do like to close out with the same question, which is what's one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
Ooh, I think this is a piece of advice that, hold on, let me think about this because I can go general or I can go craft specific.
Oh, let's go craft specific.
Okay, so the biggest piece of writing advice when I was really, like we were saying earlier, kind of diving into understanding craft is, I think, kind of like, well, yeah, duh. It's like that kind of advice, but I'd never heard it articulated this way before, and it absolutely unlocked something for me. And I think it's something that a lot of new authors, new writers are kind of struggle with, can't really wrap their heads around. And that is when you get the feedback that you need to raise the stakes of the story, what that means is you need to raise the stakes emotionally for the main character and not necessarily what is at stake. So it's not the difference between, an explosion destroying a city versus destroying the world. It is, like what ways do you have of making it more painful for the main character if they do fail at stopping said explosion? That's probably the easiest way to condense that bit of advice. But like I said, it's one of those things where it's like when you hear it, you're like, well, yeah, duh. But then I had just never heard it put so plainly before. And I was like, oh, because I would get that note pretty frequently when
Yeah,
I was
oh,
in
I've
my
gotten
episodic writing days. So yeah, now I hope that that helps somebody out there. I hope that it changes the way they kind of think about that little bit of feedback.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, yes, I agree. So anyway, thank you so much for being here. I hope
Thank you for having
everyone
me.
reads your book and becomes obsessed with perfume. And
Yes.
I'm
Come
very
talk.
excited.
Yeah, come chat with me about perfume anytime on Instagram, on Facebook. I'm around. I like love chatting about perfume and recommending scents if you guys need any recommendations.
She was so much fun to talk to. Gotta love a fellow Scorpio. But what I really liked was how she talked about raising the stakes usually means emotions, not like adding more bombs, which, again, is like she said, it's very obvious once you hear it, but sometimes not so obvious. And I thought like there's probably a lot of craft advice that feels that same way. Like, do you have any that like you've kind of like learned that is super obvious, but not necessarily that obvious.
Well, I think on her point, like making things, when you're saying raising the stakes, it's not explosions, it's
Yeah.
emotions, but that's making the stakes personal, right? Like,
Right.
I think they're kind of intertwined. Like, if you do have an explosion, how is this affecting your character personally and
Is
emotionally?
someone exploding?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, I personally like to build emotional tension. I've got a book I'm working on right now, and I can't go into a whole lot of detail. But like the two characters can't get together. Like they are not allowed to get together. Like everything is basically working against them. And like, you can really use that as an author to make it seem like they're going to get together anyway, even though it's, you know, like it's impossible for them to get together. Yeah. I'm probably not explaining that right, but
yeah. Oh, I get it. Yeah. I think it's just, there's so much that we like kind of take for granted. I don't know. It just felt like there's got to be a lot of things that feel very obvious, but when you're new, you hear it and it doesn't necessarily translate. Like you said, like personal stakes and emotional tension. Like we talk about these things, but they're easy, I guess, to misunderstand.
Yeah, I think it's like in all the things, it's like if you're going to have an explosion or if you're going to write a spicy scene between two characters, how does that advance the story emotionally? How does it progress? Like it can't just be, and then these two got it on, because they're just going to be a flat scene. It has to change something emotionally and personally for one or both characters.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, as soon as you take that answer off the table too, it diffuses something in the book, right?
Yeah.
Like I don't know how many people have watched Moonlighting at this point, but like that show is really stuck in my head.
I was literally just thinking of Moonlighting.
Yeah, so. Like those two characters, they dance around a romance for season after season after season.
Yeah.
And like that tension is what sold that show. And then the second the two of them got together, it was over. Like I think they got another season or two out of it. It was done.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful what explosions you set off.
I guess.
Yeah, in sequels.
Things got weird.
Right? Like you see that in like duologies and trilogies because, you know, usually, especially if there's a strong romantic subplot, right? They kiss at the end of, you know, the first book and then the second book is a lot harder because it's like now what do you do? Like,
yeah, you have to separate them or give some reason they split again. Cause like if it's, we just can't have like nice, healthy relationships through books. That's no fun. Like,
that always reminds me of soap operas. I don't know if you've ever watched soap operas, but my mom was like huge, like General Hospital fan. She used to watch those constantly.
Watch General Hospital.
All my children.
I would come home from school, you know, like, and like that would be what she was watching. And like, it quickly like realized that like every character is hooked up with every other character.
Yeah.
You know, cause like the show has been on forever. You know, like they cycle through all the different people. It's silly.
And you have to put someone in a coma or die and bring someone else.
The long lost twin tries to kill the person.
Yeah.
Well, it makes me wonder, like I heard they're bringing back Twilight for like one more movie.
Interesting.
And like, I'm not quite sure how that's going to work because she's already cycled through the vampire and the werewolf. So are we going to have to introduce another, you know, dude?
Oh, is it going to be based on the book that's the prequel? Because she wrote like a prequel that was like Edward's story. I wonder if that's what it's going to be.
Was it a prequel though, or did she just do a retelling? I thought she just retold everything from Edward's point of view.
It was a prequel like that it, actually now I'm not so sure. I thought that it went back in time to when he turned, but maybe I'm wrong now.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure what's coming out is it's like a follow-up. So it's like I guess, what, fifth movie? How many did they have? Sixth movie?
The children.
What? Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was more than one movie?
Yeah.
I didn't even watch the first one, so I have no idea.
There were four books, because each title was based on a phase of the moon.
Okay, so there were five movies, because the last book, they broke into two.
Yeah, split in two. Yeah. Which I actually thought was clever to name the titles after the phases of the moon, but anyway.
Yeah.
Twilight. Even Twilightier.
Yeah. I also liked how she talked about, you know, like her using her lizard brain and her creative brain and sort of how she's shifted over the years from like, you know, going intuitive to going craft to kind of blending the two and, you know, even outlining and not outlining and now headlight plotting. How do you find like over the years, like that's wavered for you, and then like how do you balance the two, the logic versus the emotion?
I mean, it shifts, I think, for me for every book. You know, I'm constantly, you know, even with like interviews that we do on here, like I listen to what, you know, these people are saying, I'm like, and I, you know, hear something new and try to incorporate it into what I'm doing, you know. So I think we're always learning. I mean, when I do interviews, I always tell everybody, like, the day I stop learning is probably the day I retire. And like I honestly believe that, because in a lot of ways that's what keeps this interesting and fun for me. So yeah, if I hear something like that, I will try it. If it doesn't work, I just move on to something else and try something different.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've been all over between pantsing and heavily plotting and sort of planting. And yeah, I think I'm actually doing the headlight plotting right now. I'm just kind of outlining where I'm at and then moving on. I had like the skeletal outline, but I don't
Yeah.
know. Yeah, it
I think
changes all the time.
I think knowing the ending is probably like the most
Yeah.
important part. Like if you know how you want the book to end, like you can have a lot of leeway in how you get there, I think.
Yeah, I don't outline at all, and I don't know the ending. I don't know anything but the title when I sit down to write, so.
That's
Wow.
fun.
Can we talk about this though, super center thing? I think that was so cool. Like someone who can smell emotions. I love it when we get systems like that.
You know, that was one of the first things that when this landed in my inbox, I was like immediately yes, because you know, it's been really interesting. My best friend has dragged me along on a perfume journey. So it was like one of those things that was, you know, she'll get a bunch of perfumes, like sample sets, and then like we'll try to smell them and see if we can pick out the base notes
Oh
and the
my
mid
gosh.
notes. And so it was really clever how she used perfume as a way of using magic.
Yeah, I have a confession. I'm one of those annoying sense-sensitive people. Like I just like no one I'm with can wear cologne. Like I'll just like die. It's like migraine, headache. But I love the idea of it. So it's like the reality and the idea of it, I love. And I think like what she was talking about, like with nostalgia of scent, because scent is such a power, it's so powerful. It's so true. So I brought my show and tell just for the YouTubers from JD's favorite movie here. This is Cliffs of
The Cliffs of
Insanity by
Insanity.
Candle. And this is the best one.
Ooh,
Labyrinth.
Labyrinth.
This one's called Jareth.
Jareth.
I love it, but it also like I can only smell it a little bit or it makes me ill. But I love the idea of
Yeah.
it.
I barely have a sense of smell, and now I wonder, because I now that I think about it, I don't know that I've ever written a scene that
Yeah.
included smell.
Oh, really?
Because it's not,
That's
I'm trying to
interesting. You got
think.
to go there. It's always
Yeah.
good to hit on that because everybody always hits on the sight related sentences or
You can come.
senses.
I think they're so like intertwined because I'm like a super taster, which is like if there is like a speck of mold on something, I'm like, this has mold in it. I can smell it too. Where my husband will be like, "What are you talking about? This tastes fine." I'm like, "No, it has mold in it." So I think like those are so. I think I'm just like hypersensitive to smell and taste. Which is where I'm not a picky eater, so that's weird, other than tomatoes, but we
Yeah,
won't get
that's
on that.
pretty.
I don't
Did
know.
you just say tomatoes? Did you just disparage
I do
tomatoes?
not like raw tomatoes. I'll eat them cooked, but I do not like them raw.
I mean, you're lucky I
What?
adore you because, like, that hurts on a soul
It's
level.
genetic. I'm like telling you, because, like, my mom hates them and I hate them and my son hates them. There's
Does
something,
cilantro taste like soap to you?
it does. I will eat it, but I don't
So,
love it.
I got that.
I don't love it.
Yeah, cilantro tastes like soap. Yeah, you might
Yeah.
as well grate a bar of Irish Spring on my spaghetti.
Wow. Anyway,
fun. I guess we should wrap up. JD, what's up next week?
Next week, we've got JT Ellison coming back on. JT is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of more than 30 suspense novels. She also publishes The Creative Edge, which is a very helpful newsletter for authors. She's back with her latest novel, You Know Why, a domestic thriller releasing on August 25th. JT Ellison.
Nice. I'll be listening to that one from my cottage while you guys take care of it. Anyway, if you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.